Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The federal government has supported scientific research for decades. Public health, weather and climate, natural resources, ongoing studies such as precipitation rates and how they change over time, sea ice measurements, global temperatures, fisheries, water and air quality research help scientists better understand what is changing and what may be needed to respond to those changes. The Trump administration is shutting down the flow of funds and taking down data. What will it mean for the future of America's global position as a leader in scientific research? We'll discuss it today on Talk of Alaska. Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. How do you know whether you need a raincoat or a parka before you leave the house for the day? Maybe you just stick your hand out the door, but more likely you look at a weather app on your phone or tune into local weather reports. Where does that information come from? What precedes the development of new medicines to treat illness? How do hunters and fishermen know when it's safe to head out on the land or water? It's all science, and it all takes long-term data collection to increase accuracy and understanding of what is happening now and what may be coming in the future. Research is expensive, and although there is some private sector research being paid for, truly autonomous studies have long been funded by the federal government on behalf of all people. Our guest today can better explain why research is costly, why it's important for the government to support it, and what happens when that data is lost. Roman Dial is a professor emeritus of Alaska Pacific University and has worked with National Science Foundation-funded research. Hello, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. Nice to be here.
Patrick Sullivan is an ecology professor and director of the Environment and Natural Resources Institute at the University of Alaska Anchorage, UAA. Hi.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to have two guests in the studio. I wish Rick Toman could be here, but Rick is with us on the line. And Rick is a climate expert at the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, UAF. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Lori. Thanks for having me.
You can also join our discussion, Alaskans. Do you have examples of research in your area that helped solve a problem? Are you a scientist worried about funds drying up for your work? Or do you think the federal government should not fund research? If so, why? Excuse me. Call us. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The publication Scientific American cites large numbers from Grant Watch, an organization that is tracking the Trump administration's science funding cancellations. It tallied more than 2,400 terminated National Institutes of Health, NIH, grants, totaling $8.7 billion, and nearly 1,700 canceled National Science Foundation, NSF, grants of $1.5 billion as of mid-June. There are legal challenges against many of these cancellations still pending. So let's start with an overview of how your work has been directly affected. Patrick, start us off. Describe your work, and have you lost grants?
Sure. So I'm a soft-funded research scientist at the University of Alaska Anchorage, which means that I'm heavily dependent upon bringing in funds from outside of the university, primarily through the National Science Foundation. We also have a long-term agreement with the United States Forest Service that helps to fund our work. I have not yet experienced a terminated NSF award, thankfully. I think that the majority of the awards that have been terminated so far are those that have had diversity, equity, and inclusion as a primary focus, although there is the threat out there that research that involves or investigates impacts of climate change may be susceptible to termination. We did have an interesting experience with one of our Forest Service agreements. My lab is responsible for analyzing tree cores that are collected on Forest Service forest inventory and analysis plots throughout the state. And we use those samples to kind of assess the health and productivity of forests statewide. We also analyze soil samples that the Forest Service collects on their plots. And we analyze those for carbon and nutrient concentrations to get a sense of the fertility of soils throughout the state. And during the Biden administration, we had an agreement with the Forest Service, and in the text of that agreement, the phrase climate change was present. And the way that our agreement with the Forest Service works is that we basically renew it on an annual basis to fund the analysis of the samples that are coming in from that summer's field work. And when we submitted our renewal request, we made sure that the language in the agreement was I guess DOGE proof, you might say, and submitted that. But when the agreement was reviewed at the federal level in the DC office, they reviewed the text of the original agreement, found the phrase climate change, and then terminated the modification, the renewal for this summer's sample analysis. Thankfully, we were able to pivot and edit the text and submit as a new agreement, and so we were able to procure the funds that we need to analyze this summer's samples. But it was definitely a bit of a scare, and we had, you know, numerous people whose jobs are dependent upon those funds. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty tense couple of weeks.
Well, thank you for giving that good example of some of these challenges. Rick, I'm going to turn to you. I know that there's a broad effect on a lot of the research that you depend on, and we'll certainly talk about that throughout the hour. But how about directly? Is your work being directly affected right now?
Well, Lori, at the moment, probably the most direct effect on my work is coming up here at the end of July here. The U.S. Department of Defense will terminate providing the satellite data that is used to monitor sea ice in the Arctic and the Antarctic, as well as it has other uses. For instance, it's able to provide high resolution winds in, say, hurricanes and typhoons. This data has been provided by the Department of Defense since 1987, and is as I said, the current schedule is for it to be stopped at the end of this month. So that is very likely to result in, at least for a while, a slowdown in the amount of and regionality of sea ice information that we have available. Of course, at the time we're at the time of year when ice is retreating. While there are other options from satellites operated by other countries, it's going to take a while to pivot to that. So that's the most immediate effect for my work.
All right, thank you. And Roman, turning to you now, you're retired, but describe your work in biology and climate research and why that's been important.
Sure, yeah, I am retired and I'm pretty much finishing up papers that research that we did as in my final years. And I'd say that a lot of what I do depends on federally hosted data or data that was collected with federal funds, because mostly I do field work, but then to place it in a larger context, I need to look at, for example, the sea ice history or the temperature and precipitation history, and gaps in those data kind of really mess up my analysis. So I fear that in the future, it's going to be more and more difficult to make any fieldwork that we do relevant in a larger context. It's really, when this happened, when the threat kind of appeared, I turned and looked at how much data that I actually look for. So in a paper Patty and I are working on right now, you know, there's USGS data, there's Weather Service data, there's permafrost data. All the larger scale data that we use is either government hosted or was government funded.
You mentioned first looking, Roman, at federal data 40 years ago, late 80s. This was in an earlier interview. Why, in your estimation, is it necessary that governments pay for this data?
Well, I think it would just be a challenge to find somebody who would step up and pay for climate data or temperature data. Just weather data is very difficult to pay for. And every village in Alaska basically needs some weather data to be collected so that airplanes and travel schedules, people know what's happening and what's gonna happen. So who's going to step up and pay for that? I don't think the airlines are going to pay for that. And it's pretty clear that even the federal government has had trouble finding people to collect that data, even when they're paid, because there's big gaps in precipitation data, especially at a lot of these village stations. So I don't know who would pay for it, basically.
And in an earlier interview, again, Roman, you gave an example of government funding as providing sort of an infrastructure for field work and sort of an analogy about the government building roads to small businesses. How do you see those things coming together in the science realm?
Sure. Well, I do. I think of myself as like a local business. I collect data locally, but I can't really get it to market, if you will, without either placing it in a larger context by looking at other people's data or by offering my data for other people to use. So in some sense, the roads that the government builds to connect communities, like the interstates that were built during the 60s, I think, or maybe even the 50s, they connected the country, and without those, our economy wouldn't be as great as it is. So without this government-hosted and government-funded data, then all the local fieldwork is really disconnected.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the effects of the loss of federal support for scientific research. In the studio with me today is Roman Dial. Roman is a professor emeritus of Alaska Pacific University, and his work has been supported by the National Science Foundation. Patrick Sullivan is also in the studio. He is an ecology professor and director of Environment and Natural Resources Institute at UAA. And Rick Tolman is on the line from Fairbanks. Rick is a climate expert at the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at UAF. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Patrick, back to you. Give us an example of some of the data you use for your work.
Okay. I think Roman and I recently kind of wrapped up a study that does a good job of demonstrating the importance of long-term federal monitoring data for contextualization of our findings. We did kind of a case study of the Salmon River watershed in Kobuk Valley National Park. And this is a watershed that has been heavily impacted by thawing permafrost, which has exposed sulfide minerals in the bedrock to weathering. And that weathering process is producing acid, which leaches metals out of the rocks, and they are ultimately flushed into the streams. And so we're seeing really strong stream degradation as a result of this process. And so we did field work over a number of years. We collected samples up and down the salmon and from its tributaries analyzed those for metal concentrations, examined those metal concentrations in the context of the EPA's thresholds for toxicity to aquatic organisms. And then we, in order to kind of put our data in context, we needed to use USGS stream gauge data from a number of nearby streams to show whether our samples were collected during high flow or low flow or near median flow conditions. We also needed to be able to demonstrate how the water chemistry in the salmon had changed from previous years before degradation. And thankfully, the National Park Service had been doing routine monitoring of many of the watersheds in Northwest Alaska. And so they had historical data that we could use to demonstrate that the salmon was indeed like a pristine watershed, you know, all the way up until 2019, when all of a sudden it turned orange and turbid and started to show these really high metal concentrations. So those are examples of the importance of the federal data for providing context for these more detailed studies. And I think it's worth noting that the USGS, the Park Service, FAA, like a number of these federal agencies support this routine long-term data collection and monitoring, whereas the National Science Foundation, for instance, funds really short-term projects to address very specific questions and test very specific hypotheses. And so there's this really important relationship between those two funding sources in order to be able to answer these really important questions, but then also be able to put them in context.
You mentioned, Patrick, that you had a glimpse of what loss of data can mean when the National Center was taken offline by flooding in North Carolina, where it's located. Talk about that and what happened.
Yeah, so that's the National Center for Environmental Information, which is this really crucial clearinghouse for many of the long-term data sets that are collected by the federal government, especially weather data. And, Roman and I have been working a lot in Northwest Alaska, and so for instance, the Kotzebue weather record is really important to us. We use it for really almost all of our studies in one way or another. And it's a really, really high quality record with very few gaps. And we need to regularly go to the NCEI to update that data set to reflect the most recent observations. And following the hurricane and like the massive flooding in Ashland, the NCEI went offline for several weeks.
Asheville.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Sorry. Yes. Did I say Nashville? Yeah. Asheville. It was just kind of a glimpse into like a potential future where we wouldn't have access to those data anymore, and it was kind of frightening, and it would degrade the quality of the science that we can do if we don't have access to those data.
And for all of you, I know that there are a lot of efforts underway and have been for quite a while, people that sort of were concerned about this potentially happening. So there's been efforts, I think, by independent scientists and others to gather as much of that information off sites of the federal government as possible before they go dark. Do you have any idea of how much of that has been done, and or is that still just sort of an ongoing process?
I don't know.
Don't know.
I know that we regularly download and update files that we're working with, but I'm not aware of anyone who's gone in and kind of systematically tried to like download like massive quantities of data because they're concerned that it might go away.
How about you, Rick? Any thoughts about that, about people trying to preserve some of this information? And I realize that if it's static, it's only good for so long also.
Yeah, so there has been a lot of efforts at that. Things like weather and climate data actually live in many places. So this is data that has been gathered in the past. So that isn't going to go away. But as Patty was just describing, the fact that somebody has it somewhere, if you don't know how to get to it, that's of no value to you. And so a place like National Centers for Environmental Information as the one-stop shop for, in its name, environmental information, the fact that you can get the same information from the Iowa State Mesonet, who, besides a specialist, wouldn't even ever think of such a thing? No one. So it really highlights the importance. It's not just, does the data exist anywhere? Is it backed up anywhere? But do people that need that information know how to get it?
For all of you, again, why is research so expensive? What are the factors that go into gathering, aggregating, kind of distilling down this information over a broad swath of different scientific areas? Why is it so expensive to undertake these studies?
Well, science is done by people, and people are expensive. You know, when you factor in like their salary and their benefits and their leave, you know, when we construct budgets to do science, you know, the area that always grows the budget the fastest is adding personnel.
Sure.
Analyses can be really expensive, you know.
Yeah, like laboratory analysis.
Laboratory analyses, you know, if you have to send off samples for like DNA analysis, that's really costly.
Because the machinery to look at the samples is expensive, and then to keep those things maintained, those laboratories have to hire people to keep them. It's not like you can just park it in the corner and use it when you need it. You almost always need to feed it something, or it goes bad almost. So you need to have postdocs, which are expensive.
And of course, then there's actually deploying out to places that might be very remote to gather some of this information, correct? I'm sure that when you're doing field work, it's not, it's expensive to get there.
Yeah, that's right. We do a lot of work in kind of remote areas of like the Brooks Range, for instance. And, you know,
The travel's really expensive to hire pilots to fly in and fly out, and you need specialized people to do those trips. It's expensive.
Rick, turning back to you, as you mentioned, there are other satellites that are not owned by the federal government that will still be collecting sea ice data. Do American scientists have easy access to that data, or would you have to pay for it if it's another country's information?
So that's going to depend. Things like satellite data that's used to process sea ice is readily available. It's readily available to anyone online. Other information that is currently provided by the federal government, for instance, lightning data in Alaska. There are companies that gather worldwide lightning data, but at least some of those, if you want to see it, you have to pay for it. So it's going to vary depending on exactly what you're looking at. There is a lot of information that gathered by satellites that will be readily available and will be able to replace information if U.S. satellite data is cut off, as we're seeing with the sea ice information. But really, the big problem will be stuff that's gathered in place. We can't get weather and climate observations at Kotzebue from the Canadian government or the Russian government. That's going to have to be from the U.S. Similarly, with fisheries surveys in Alaska waters, there's only one place that can come from. So remote sensing, we have some hope, whether it's readily available for free or to pay, but that those in situ observations, that's where we don't have much in the way of fallback.
That's a really, really important distinction. And other things that don't necessarily affect Alaska, but the nation, such as hurricane information, can the U.S. access other nations' data on that? And how helpful would that be as it's getting into U.S. waters?
Well, certainly, you know, from the operational meteorological perspective, meteorologists are agnostic. You know, there's never too much data, and we don't care where it comes from. Of course, quality control is important, and professional meteorologists are trained to do that on the fly because that's the time scale that folks are working on. So, yes, some information is available from other countries. Here in Alaska, of course, we're moving into that time of year when we are closely monitoring what's going on with typhoons in the Western Pacific, because historically they may make a turn towards Alaska and affect our weather. That's being monitored with, for instance, Japanese geostationary satellites.
And sticking with you for a minute here, Rick, before we go to a break here in a few minutes, in an earlier interview, you said you sort of live and breathe federal-supported data. Describe what that means on a day-to-day basis in your work.
Yeah, so in preparation for this show, I actually went through the bookmarks on my computer and just kind of made a list of all the links that go to federal data, and it's really quite an amazingly long list. So not just sea ice, of course, but sea surface temperatures. This time of year, as mentioned, lightning, all the weather stations that the BLM through the Alaska Fire Service has deployed around Alaska in support of fire weather activities, fisheries, upper air observations. Either Patty or Roman mentioned the USGS, the river gauge data. In the spring, of course, what's one of the major features for Alaska? Breakup. The National Resources Conservation Service gathers nearly all of the snow water equivalent, how much water's in the snowpack that we need going into breakup to understand the severity threat.
And for all of you, the importance of continuity. Why can't you make comparisons every 5 or 10 years instead of every year? Why is it important to have yearly data sets?
Let me mention some problems with that. I do a lot of the analysis in the work that Patty and I do together. And when you have a time series analysis, which means, you know, you're collecting data periodically, like every year, let's say. And usually there's a rule in geography that says everything is related to everything else, but things that are closer together are more closely related. And the same holds for time, you know. So over time, everything is sort of related. But things that happen closely are more likely to be related in some sense. And when you have those gaps in the data, you can't rely on the statistical means to separate out what is really happening from just sort of an overall trend. And so Patty and I have worked on quite a few projects where we needed time series data, and it's always a bugaboo when there's a big gap in the data. And you just really don't know what's happening. And in the standard statistical techniques, you know, a few outliers can really leverage the results that you get. And so you need that to fill in so you don't have these outliers that are bending your data, so to speak. So it's really important to have continuous data when it's time series data. You don't want any gaps. And by time series, I mean, again, that periodically collected temperature, precipitation, sea ice, caribou, fish, anything that you need year after year data.
Thank you for laying that out so succinctly and clearly. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about what happens when there is a loss of federally supported research, scientific research, and that data is going away, and how that affects all kinds of areas of science that we need to know about. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing today the loss of federal support for scientific research. In the studio with me today is Roman Dial. Roman is a professor emeritus of Alaska Pacific University. Patrick Sullivan is also in the studio with us. Patrick is an ecology professor and director of the Environment and Natural Resources Institute at UAA. And Rick Tolman is on the line from Fairbanks. Rick is a climate expert at the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy at UAF. You can join us statewide if you have questions or comments, if you're concerned about data loss, if you've had seen the direct benefits of having science assist projects in your community or region. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. You can also call in if you think government shouldn't be in the research business. If you have ideas about that, you're welcome to join us as well. We have an email from Doug in Anchorage. Doug says, the graphics generated by Rick and his colleagues and posted on the easily accessible ACCAP website have been the inspiration of numerous classroom discussion and student science projects related to climate. Doug says, thank you for all your public outreach efforts. All right, Roman, I want to get back to you, and then I'm sure Rick will have something to say about this too. You referenced earlier in a pre-interview that sea ice data is the best example of why long-term data is important. For people who may think, so what? You're watching it happen. What does that change or help with? What would you say to that?
Right. Well, it turns out that sea ice data, or I should say that sea ice and its loss might be driving most of the changes that Patty and I have seen up in the Brooks Range and the North Slope. So Patty's got like a 20-year research site that he's been visiting like several times a year. And myself, I've been visiting the Brooks Range for almost 50 years. And so I've seen a lot of change, but I've only sort of been studying in a formal way changes there for the last 10 years. But this sea ice data helps give me a longer lens. And what we found is that there's a lot of things that are correlated with the loss of sea ice. For example, surprisingly, tree line advance seems to be strongly determined by how rapidly or how much open water there is. And trees are things that, you know, grow really slowly. And so without a long-term perspective, you wouldn't be able to sort of see what's happening. And the way we can see this is not only are trees in new places, but we can age the trees, and then we can look at the tree growth through the tree rings and compare it to long-term temperature records, long-term precipitation records, and this open water in the Arctic Ocean. And surprisingly, trees seem to respond more to the open water in the Arctic Ocean than they do to temperature or precipitation. Similarly, with caribou, we were looking at some caribou mortality data that was collected by the Park Service and Fish and Game, and cow mortality. And cow mortality sort of takes a big jump once the open water in the Arctic Ocean reaches a certain threshold in October. It kind of, you need to look at the October sea ice extent or open water, because that seems to be when there's it's cold out, but there's open water. So you get this, you can get a really strong, what they'd call in Buffalo, New York, a lake effect, where moisture rises up out of the open water, hits the cold air, and then comes down as snow or freezing rain. And that seems to have some impact on all these organisms up there, everything from parka squirrels to caribou.
So curious that the trees, is that being studied, why the trees are responding more to open water than to local temperature and precipitation?
Well, Patty and I published a paper in Science, I guess, last year, and it had, nobody's really responded to that. We laid it out pretty clearly, I would say, in that paper that there is this really strong correlation, but we didn't try to explain why it was happening, and nobody yet has published on that.
Yeah, it's probably kind of an integrative signal where the sea ice kind of captures both the effects of temperature, so it kind of contains the temperature signal, but then it also impacts precipitation. And so in some ways, it's kind of like a catch-all variable that explains both changes in temperature and precipitation.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment, and then we'll get Rick's comments in here. Nancy is in Seldovia. Hello, Nancy.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I was just wondering. I have been working with the Board of Fisheries, Board of Game, the legislature, and I just noticed that there's very few scientists delivering any messages to them. And a lot of times it's because the structure is broken of the bridge that actually creates this information to go to the policymakers from the scientists. So how can we create a new improved structure of delivering this science to policymakers who are the people that can apply this instead of the narrative being overwhelmed by paid lobbyists with biased science? And, you know, it's a real problem in the state of Alaska, and I'm sure in other areas also, but because of budgets and credibility fears, the scientists don't step up or can't step up. And so we need a means of creating a messenger that's credible and that can talk in layman's terms so that policymakers who are mostly lawyers and, you know, teachers and, you know, can be updated on the on what the true science is stating, not a biased science. I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nancy, for the call. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join us. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Rick, turning to you, pick it up there about the importance of that continuity. And the sea ice data for the Arctic Ocean, the Beaufort first, talk about the changes in the extent of that ice, the dates for freeze up and thaw and thickness in the last 40 years.
Yeah, so we have satellite data that started in the fall of 1978. Obviously, people have been interested in sea ice for far, far longer than that. But that fall of 1978 is when we have that daily data starting. In the Beaufort Sea, we see up through the very end of the 20th century, basically one regime, the Beaufort Sea was mostly ice covered most of the year, melt out in the late summer and early fall, did often not extend very far offshore at all. In some years, it never completely left the Alaska coast. Completely different regime now, with ice now routinely in September, hundreds of miles north of the coast. You mentioned thickness. That is perhaps the most significant change that we've seen in the Arctic over the last 47 years, with almost a complete loss of old multi-year ice, that very thick, very fresh ice. Into the 1990s, the Arctic was dominated by that older, thicker ice. Nowadays, there's the only old ice left is a thin ribbon across northern Greenland and the northernmost Canadian Arctic islands that does move in the current to north of Alaska, but it accounts for just a small percentage of the ice. That's really been the largest change that we've seen in Arctic ice. And we know that all of this from federally funded satellite data.
And talk about the Chukchi Sea, the differences in how it's changing compared to the Beaufort.
Yeah, the Chukchi Sea, which of course from north of the Bering Strait all the way up to Utqiagvik and Point Barrow. And the changes there have really, really been dramatic. And as Roman was mentioning, the loss of that, particularly the autumn sea ice and also the thinner ice, new ice, most of the rest of the year, has just created a sea change. That's why Northwest Alaska is the fastest warming area in the state, because of that loss of autumn sea ice. That's why every single October since 2001 at Utqiagvik has been much warmer than the historical average. There's hardly any variability in the October temperature now at Utqiagvik because of that loss of ice, a wholly new climate for Utqiagvik than compared to the 20th century. Ice is also, on average, leaving earlier. That has much more variability than the autumn ice, which is now, since 2001, isn't there and takes a long time to freeze up. often nowadays, the Chukchi Sea isn't frozen over until we get into December.
And Roman, you had mentioned earlier that all of this is affecting snowfall, the lake effect. More snow means the Arctic is much less dry. How does that affect the environment and ecology of that region?
Well, I think, you know, it is pretty amazing the effect that snow has on the landscape. You know, for a long time, I wasn't interested in sea ice or the winter snowfall or permafrost, and now I'm super fascinated by all of those and how they're linked. So as the sea ice retreats, this lake effect dumps a lot more snow onto Northwest Alaska landscapes, and that snow acts like a big warm blanket. You know, anybody who's slept in a snow cave knows how warm it is. And so this deeper snow is insulating the ground, and we've been having these warmer summers, hotter summers with sometimes big precipitation events that are thawing the permafrost. You know, so there's permafrost that, there's the ground that thaws every year, and that's the active layer. And so we have these deeper active layers because we have hotter summers, we have more rainfall events that percolate into the soil and thaw this ground. And then before that stuff can refreeze, we get these big blankets of snow, so they're insulating this this active layer. So basically what's happening is we're eroding the permafrost, or, you know, the climate is eroding the permafrost during the summer. And then in the winter, the permafrost isn't healing in some sense. In other words, it's not replenishing or replacing itself because it's got this big blanket of snow. So all of these things are intertwined. And then when you have this thawing permafrost, then we get back to this phenomenon that Patty was describing, these rusting rivers or stained streams that are probably playing a role in decimating the Pacific salmon populations, not only in Northwest Alaska, like on the famous Salmon River, but perhaps even in the Yukon River. So there are all these cascading effects, and it's hard to piece them all together if you don't have the data available to sort of see the bigger picture.
All right, we are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the importance of federally supported scientific data as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation about the importance of federal support for scientific research. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Patrick, earlier you had in another interview, you characterized your work with funding from the National Science Foundation and the Forest Service as hypothesis-driven research. Describe what that means for us non-scientists.
So hypothesis-driven research is really when you have a very specific question that you want to investigate, and you have ideas as to like what might be happening, like what the mechanisms are that could support a particular prediction. And what we do in hypothesis driven research is we go out and we collect data to test alternative hypotheses that could explain a phenomenon that we're observing. So like a good example maybe from this rusting rivers research that we've been doing is, you know, we saw all these streams turn orange, and we had some ideas, some hypotheses as to why they might be turning orange. One of the hypotheses was that thawing permafrost was exposing sulfide minerals to weathering and producing acid and leaching metals, including iron, into the streams. That was our acid rock drainage hypothesis. But we also know from past research that that permafrost thaw can sometimes lead to like wetter soils in wetland ecosystems. And when the soils get really wet, the form of iron that's present in the soil transitions to a more mobile form. And under those conditions, that iron then can be flushed out of the wetlands and into the streams. And so we had these two competing hypotheses: our acid rock drainage hypothesis and our wetland hypothesis, and we went out to test them to see which hypothesis had more support in the data. And the way that we could test them was by looking primarily at other metals other than iron in the streams. You know, if we were seeing high concentrations of like cadmium, for instance, that can only be produced by acid rock drainage and not through this wetland process.
We had a question that was from a caller, but we have it by email now, that was asking how potential cuts to funding, or the cuts to funding, they're not potential, they're happening, could impact future generations of scientists. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that's one of the most concerning aspects. You know, some of us who are more advanced in our careers are able to kind of shelter ourselves to some degree from the impacts, but people who are in early career stages are much more exposed to these cuts. You know, their salaries are much more dependent on, you know, going from grant to grant, for instance. And, you know, if suddenly grants get terminated, or if the success rate of proposals that you submit declines substantially, then we might be less able to support graduate students and postdocs to help us with our science.
Rick, before this program, in an earlier interview, you were saying that there is a bit of a bright spot related to climate data. Tell us about that. We need some brighter news here.
Yeah, so this spring, we were concerned, very concerned, that one of the primary interfaces that we use to slice and dice climate data, this is daily observations from weather stations around the country. There was a threat that that would be terminated. The contract to run that through the regional climate centers would be terminated. And that was supposed to happen on May 31st. May 31st came and went, and software, online software package remained available. It remains available to this day. So that was a threat that did not come to pass, at least at the time frame that we feared it would. So this day we'll take all the good news we can get. So we still have that very powerful way to examine this large century-long data set now.
Hopefully you talking about it on air won't change that suddenly. How does this lack of long-term data sets affect the quality and outcomes of research work? Does it call it into question? Does it make other researchers doubt the credibility or make it more difficult to get things published if you don't have that information to back up what you're finding?
I'd like to address that.
Please
one.
Do.
With respect to these rusting rivers, when the rusting river phenomenon first sort of emerged, you know, we weren't publishing on it. We were actually posting things on Facebook. Hey, have you seen this? And a lot of people would come forward, geologists would come forward and say, oh, well, that kind of happens all the time. And it is known as natural acid rock drainage, and it does happen. Those economic geologists or exploration geologists, the ones who go look for, you know, the new Red Dog mines, for example, they're looking for this kind of thing where the water comes in contact with ore deposits and turns orange. It's a signal to them, hey, there's mineralization here. And so a lot of people were saying, oh, well, this isn't really, you know, a new thing. And sure, death isn't a new thing either, but when everybody's dying, we should take notice. You know what I mean? So without these long-term imagery data sets, Rick kind of talked about a little bit the DOD paying for this. I think this is what he was talking about, but the Department of Defense pays for this private satellite agency to sell, or for us to use, really high quality, like the kind of when you look in Google Earth and you can see the dog in your neighbor's backyard. That kind of imagery is great for going back in time and looking around to see, hey, when did this phenomenon turn on? And so if we didn't have access to that, we would have no way to address people who were saying, hey, well, this is, happens all the time, but you can look back and there are these timestamps when things were turning orange and you can say, oh, look, it matches right up with when it started getting really warm in Kotzebue, for example. So all these data allow us to look back and then see that the changes that are happening now are unique.
Mm. And Rick and Patrick, we know that Alaska weather forecasting is so critical for life-saving, making sure that people know what they need to know before they go out. In a state as vast as this one is, where we have so many different zones from high Arctic conditions to temperate rainforest, is that the area of science that you're most concerned with losing? And talk a little bit about how, why that is such an important thing for this state. Rick, do you want to start off there?
Sure. So, you know, there's nothing more basic to our health, to our safety, to what we do as Alaskans on the land and sea than the weather. You know, the often told, you know, comment that in Alaska, talking about the weather is not small talk. And so having this basic information is going to inform what Alaskans are doing. It's going to inform the ability of pilots to fly safely. It's going to inform the most complicated weather models in existence for Weather Service and other entities to produce forecasts of on land and on the ocean of upcoming conditions. So without having that data or not having it reliably, it doesn't do any good if you've got a weather station at your community airstrip and it's not providing information. That is not helpful. And so having this information is critical in every aspect of our lives as Alaskans.
And for all of you, we only have a couple of minutes left here, and I want to try to get a couple more questions in. Factual information can at times be frightening and go against what people believe or want to believe. How do you see this shutting down of things that some don't want to face? Science, data collection. What happens when people only look at what they agree with? I had a caller yelling at me last week that he was glad the government was taking our funding away because all we ever do is talk about climate change. And that, of course, isn't true, but I feel that it's a common sentiment with many people. What are your concerns in that regard? About people just seeing what they want down the rabbit hole?
Well, yeah, I think it's a pretty obvious ploy. Like, if we can't see that changes are happening, it's much easier to deny that they are happening. You know, if you close your eyes, you won't see the murder, you know, or if you close your eyes, there's no homeless problem. Or if you stop counting people who are infected with a disease, there's no disease problem. So I think it's a cynical ploy to shut down anything that might affect economic gain.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think this halting of data collection says to the rest of the world? America has invested in science for a very long time. Now that's changing. What might that do for the future of cooperative science and innovation with other nations? Patrick?
Well, I would like to think that some of these other nations might step up and help to fill the void that we might be creating by, like, reducing the amount of science that we do. But I fear that, the current administration kind of has a tendency to create trends in other nations that kind of mirror what we're experiencing here. And so that's especially scary because it suggests that other nations might not step up to fill the void.
Mm. Rick, your thoughts here?
I think the biggest concern that I have is that with this, with the reduction or dismantling of data sets of science education, that this is not what this will proceed to a point where it's not reversible in shorter than the generational time scale, that a change of administration cannot just set the clock back to what it was. It will take decades to recover and to some extent, it won't be recoverable at all. For instance, gaps in regular observations. No amount of money can fill those in once we're in the future.
All right. Well, thank you so much to my very astute guests, Roman Dial, Patrick Sullivan, and Rick Tolman. We've been talking about the loss of federal support for scientific research. Thanks to our engineer, Dave Waldron, was on the board today. Our producer is Madeline Rose. Our editor is Andy Feit. And on the phone, Sam Lang helped us out. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.